Once I had made this decision, I felt a lot better in myself. I turned the business trip into a holiday, cabling my office to say that the business trip was off, but the pleasure trip was on. That's the best of being the boss. You can make your own decisions and there's nobody to dispute them. In the same way that I had mingled with the crowds in Calcutta, so I now mixed with the throngs of Bombay. I remembered a tag from my school days when we had been studying the works of Mark Twain. The famous American humorist had remarked about the bejeweled natives in India. Things must have changed since his day, for although I saw any amount of native Indians, I saw precious few jewels. Even in the hotels that I visited, jewels were conspicuous by their absence. The handful of faded old ladies who haunted such places aired nothing but their memories. I decided that the only way to see the real India, the India that is ignored by the tourists, was to travel the whole length of the country by train, going third class in order to study the natives at first hand. So I bought a ticket from Madras down on the southeast coast, paid my hotel bill, handed out the inevitable backsheesh, and set out for the south, ruefully thinking that the whole trip had been one ghastly failure. Again, Mark Twain was brought to my mind. He had spoken about the charm and delight of traveling by train in India. Indeed, he had so rhapsodized about it that he had asserted that the delight of it was beyond words. Once more, things must have changed since his day. There was one excellent word for it. Smell. I had hardly settled in my compartment before I became aware of the smell. It was not the bottle of scotch that I immediately uncorked once the train had started. That in my itself was no mean feat, not the train starting, but the fact that I had a bottle of scotch to uncork. It is very difficult for anybody to get hold of whiskey in India, but as I was an overseas visitor, I had been lucky. Thanks to the British, it is possible to travel pretty well everywhere in India. But as I discovered, though you can travel far and wide, you can escape from the smell. You can't escape from the smell. If one has to love humanity, then in India one also has to learn how to love and live with the halitosis. I left Bombay on the 10th of October 1964. In the 10 days that I had spent trying to do business in Calcutta and Bombay, I had achieved precisely nothing. That was, I suppose, the reason for my pessimism, but I looked forward to the long rail journey, and it would give me the opportunity to see a great deal of this enormous country. The British, I understood, had handed over the railways in fair nick to the Indian authorities. However, that with one thing and another, maintenance had not been quite so good since independence as it had been before. Accidents do occur a little more frequently, and the people who travel look upon them as an occupational hazard. Some extremely nervous or cautious travelers take all steps possible to make sure that, as far as possible, everything is in order. But they are the exception and not the rule. Never is the national characteristic of fatalism more evident in India than when traveling by train. Judge my surprise then, when I noticed my traveling companion make a careful check of everything in the compartment. It was this eccentricity that made me notice him. The man was obviously a sahib left over from the British occupation. He was very well dressed and had the unmistakable stamp of authority in his bearing. But he himself checked the door handle and lock, the windows, and tested the seats as though he was a very nervous disposition and quite unaccustomed to making a long railway journey. When he had tested everything to his satisfaction, my companion took the seat opposite me. Courteously, he inclined his head in greeting, just as courteously I acknowledged the greeting, at the same time offering him a drink from my bottle. This he accepted. I watched him closely as he savored the scotch and drained the flask top into itself. I had poured the drink. "Forgive me," I began, "but the way you inspected all the fitments of the compartment, I take it you are somewhat nervous of traveling by train?" My companion smiled. "Not at all, sir. I'm merely curious." He waved his hand to indicate the various notices with which the compartment was liberally besprinkled. I must admit that the man had a point. I have traveled on most of the major railway roads of the world and on several of the minor ones as well. If I had been asked, I have said that down on page 37 on the Ronald Stevens 14, top 14 of the original book. Well, go on. I have said that the limit of trust is shown by some of the Latin American railways, which exhibit prominently in the compartment such shattering notices as "Do not accept food, drink, or tobacco from strangers. They may be doped." Well, as I say, I would have said that these notices were the ultimate of man's distrust for man, until I read the notices that my companion indicated on the Bombay Madras mail. "Beware of thieves," one notice exhorted me. Another told me to "beware of thieves asking permission to sleep on the floor of this carriage." Yet a third notice begged me to, "so please secure the safety catches, latches, and barrel bolts printed on the doors and windows, particularly at night. Well, we seem, I remarked, to be traveling among thieves. An honest man would seem to be a rarity in India. I had said this as a joke, but my companion frowned slightly as if I had said something very unpleasant indeed. So I tried to retrieve my gaff by offering him another drink of whiskey. He accepted, and cordial relations were once more established. I had indeed to travel third class so that I might have the opportunity of studying the different types of native Indians. But at the last moment I had shied from this, the smell no doubt being responsible, and I had taken a ticket on the fourth berth compartment. My companion and I tried the only two traveling in this compartment, and after the introductory drinks, we settled ourselves down on opposite corner seats and watched the Indian landscape passing by. I was so absorbed in what I saw that I entirely forgot about my traveling companion. It took it that he was equally interested, for he never interrupted by so much as a word. The Bombay Madras mail had left the early afternoon. After I had watched the envoys of Bombay disappear into the distance, I began to think about sleeping arrangements for the night. Faintly amused, I read the warning notices once more, and then turned my attention to the four bunks with which the compartment was furnished. I have already mentioned that my companion and I occupied lower seats that by night served as a very comfortable berths. I have already mentioned that my companion and I occupied lower seats that by night served as a very comfortable berth. I inspected the mattress and found it to be first class. I wasn't too so sure about the blankets, which seemed rather fluffy, and therefore I thought might be itchy. My companion, seeing me thus occupied, carried out a similar inspection of the other berth. He appeared satisfied, settled himself once more in the corner, and then leant forward and spoke in a continual whisper to me. The nearness of the man gave me the opportunity to study him at even closer quarters than I had already done without appearing to be rude. I was aware, as I had not been aware before, of the extraordinary qualities of his eyes. Any amount of cliches had been written about eyes. I would not have designed more expressive eyes than those my traveling companion had. On such occasions as these, one must turn to cliches, for however hack-eyed they may be, they do underline a basic truth. And in very truth, my companion had eyes that really talked. His eyes were not the only impressive feature about the man. I have already spoken of his general air of authority, an air that he maintained even when relaxing in his seat. I guessed his height at a little under 6 foot, 5 foot 10 or 11 perhaps. His height was accentuated by his slim build and by his extreme long legs, which he kept tucked underneath his shirt. But what fascinated me as much as his eyes were his unusually long, slender fingers. On second thought, it wasn't so much the fingers that fascinated me as the fingertips. He wore some kind of protection over them, unlike any form of glove that I have ever seen. And that isn't the only way to describe the style of the protective covering, fingertip gloves. For the rest, he was off-white in color, light brown. I suppose you would call it a very light brown indeed. Even his hair were light brown. I doubt if he weighed 100 pounds fully dressed, but for all his slim build, he did not give the appearance of being physically weak. Indeed, on the contrary. Something else arrested my attention. I would not help observing that every time he inhaled, so he contracted his hands. Indeed, it seemed that he had to have recourse to deep inhalation with every breath, rather as though he suffered from respiratory trouble. Not that there were any external evidence of this, for, as I have said, he looked a very healthy specimen indeed. I suppose my clothes scrutiny of him must have made me my companion slightly uneasy, although he was courtesy himself when he addressed me. It was then that I received one further shock, for his voice did not appear to come from his mouth, but rather from a little speaking device that he had clipped to his chest. As we entered into conversation, I noticed a peculiarity about his speech. Although, as I have already mentioned, his English was impeccable, and he spoke fluently enough, yet there was always a slight but definite hesitation before he spoke. It was as if he was making the mental effort to say the first word, after which all the others would come spontaneously. But that first word was all the others was labored. It was a trick of speech that was not at all unpleasant. Indeed, I found myself waiting for it in much the same way as a man whose lover has the slightest of impediments in her speech waits for the enrolled R, as the key signal for their oneness. His voice was nothing remarkable. There was a certain basic musical quality about it, nothing that bestoked the great orator. Indeed, I suppose that the very cadence of his voice gave a certain quality of monotony to it. Yet all the time he was speaking, so he was smiling a warm, friendly smile. He introduced himself as Sa Tu Ra. Obviously, Sa Tu Ra was a man of great charm. Soon my first reaction of surprise was replaced by those of warmth and friendship as we got deeper and deeper into our conversation. And while we were talking, the train turned deeper and deeper into the heart of Mother India, about 100 miles out of Mumbai. The train passes through the last of tunnels that pierce the highlands, which until the coming of modern engineering skills had proved an almost impassable barrier. It was soon after passing through this tunnel that Satura asked me one or two personal questions. "You are not English," he remarked. "I was led to believe you were." "I'm sorry," I said. "I had no intention to mislead you." "No, I'm not English. But I speak several languages, and the best way to communicate in India is by using English." I looked at my watch as the express train to Madras, hissing like a dry cleaner steam press, came to stop in a large station. It was just on 8, and I looked out of the window to see if I could find the name of the station, that we were some way from any name board. Full night was almost upon us. The sky, despite the light rain that was falling, tended to be an orange-yellow in color. Orange-yellow, the color of ripening corn. But only the great Lord Shiva would know how many people in India would be left without food that night. On the station platform, hundreds of the thinnest, hungriest looking, bare shankered fellow milled around. The lucky minority would eat a few tortilla patties, which wrinkled old ladies, squatting before charcoal braziers, were cooking. Some of the crones were sitting cooking right in front of the station master's office. They did not take any notice of anybody, but concentrated on their homely cooking, blowing into the charcoal embers in order to get the maximum heat. Everywhere, hustling, barefooted porters bustled about carrying the most unbelievable bundles, consisting of ragged bags, boxes, and other items of luggage. These they piled into their backs and heads as if they were piling rubbish onto a garbage truck. To add to the din, infants were yelling, passengers were complaining in the loudest possible voices. Suspicious travelers and would-be passengers furtively eyed their companions. Perhaps these notices were necessary after all. Amidst this hullabaloo, I saw the poorest, most wretched woman I had ever seen in my entire life. She held a fretful baby in one hand and held out the other for a tip. There she stood, a ragged, bedraggled daughter of Mother India, with a hungry child crying for food. This, I reflected, was the true face of India. Her Arabian Nights splendors were a figment of imagination, Mark Twain sparkling jewels with spurious gems. Here was the stark reality of India. An emaciated, ragged woman. A crying, fretful, hungry child. There they stood on that unknown platform, a gross, obscene monument to India and hunger. As I watched this woman and her child, a Brahmin pushed roughly past her, I could see the look of utter disdain on the man's face as he pushed her to one side. I could observe the look of disdain turn to one of horror as he realized that he had touched this untouchable woman. Without a word, Satura left the compartment. Through the darkening window, I could see him moving through the crowds. I rose from my berth and exit to find out what he was up to. A magazine seller wheeled his trolley up to my companion. Satura waved him away. The man was only interested in the woman and their baby. You did not have to be a doctor to see that the might of dying, probably of malnutrition and neglect. A handsome bearded European stopped at a little drama unfolding on the platform. He looked with compassion on the woman and the child. Compassion turned to astonishment as he saw Satura press a coin into the woman's hand and a tablet into the baby's mouth. I too was astonished as what I had seen. It was still more astounded when Satura returned to the compartment and without a word of explanation beckoned to me. Please come with me, he said softly. There is much to be done. I did not think of arguing, much less of disobeying. Instead, I left my comfortable berth and followed Satura onto the platform. He fed away to the last of the coaches, a third-class one that was swarming with passengers. He clambered aboard and I scrambled after him. When I found myself the hordes of people inside the railway coach, I was glad that I had changed my mind and I had decided to travel first class. As I looked around me, I was cross that there could be such extremes of poverty in a country that had its full quota of really rich men. More, why was there poverty anywhere on earth? I could not answer that question. Perhaps a trained economist or some other expert could have come up with a satisfactory answer, and I just knew that I could not, nor even would be able to. The poorest of the poor travel like so many head of cattle in the third-class wagon of the Indian railways. Perhaps all third-class passengers are not so abjectly poor that the wretched woman and her child. But at a cursory glance, it seemed that all the women and children in the coach suffered from some degree of poverty and deprivation. Well, it has passed half an hour and come to top of page 19 in the book, which is page 43 in the original book, it seems to, from this bad printed or photographed PDF file, which is not easy to read. But I take a break here and continues on the next part for those interested to following this book, which is very not easy to get hold of.